Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by one of our contributors, Ashanti Omka.
Hello.
Hello. And our deputy editor, Matt Matum.
Hello.
Hello. So this week we are talking to the Russo brothers about The Grey Man, as well as assessing where the Crawdads Sing, Paws of Fury, and Miss Marvel's season closer. But first of all, before we get onto those, what have you guys been watching this week, Ashanti?
Well, I've been watching The Grey Man, actually. Everything is about The Grey Man at the moment. Everyone's talking about it. And for me, I'd caught up with the Russo brothers and the Noosh. And that was really special for me in terms of the representation of the cinema I grew up on. The Noosh, I kind of watched him from his first ever movie. He comes from a big kind of movie family in Kollywood, which is South Indian cinema in Tamil Nadu. And I'm Tamil, he's Tamil. This guy is, he's magical because he's a singer, he's a filmmaker, he's an actor. It's lovely that the Russo brothers have introduced him to Hollywood in this way. What better a way to kind of start his journey there, being kind of a formidable foe to that lot in The Grey Man. And to hear Jessica Henwick, Regé Jean Page, and Ryan Gosling himself talking about the Noosh, saying how fabulous he has been, how professional he is. Back in the day, you know, he was a teenager when he was pulled into this. He wanted to be a chef. But his family kind of said, look, come and join the family business. And they put him in one movie. From then, his trajectory has been amazing. It's great that Hollywood has given him this big intro. And in this film, in The Grey Man, I think there's been mixed reviews for the film. I can see why that is. But at the same time, I can see why there could be spin-offs. And, you know, the Russos have kind of teased this, you know, the Grey Man universe, and the fact that Avik San, that the Noosh plays in this, could get his prequel movie, which will be very exciting.
What have you been feasting your eyes on, Matt?
Well, I've actually got something exciting to say that I've been watching this week, because it's going to be out of embargo by the time this goes out, which is I saw Nope, Jordan Peele's new film.
Yes. And
I won't say too much about it now, because one, because I'm sure we'll discuss it in detail in a further episode down the line, and also because it really is one of those films that you want to go to as kind of cold as possible. It's sort of lots of surprises.
Don't watch the trailer.
Yeah, like the second trailer gives quite a lot away. Like the first trailer was fine, but the second does give a lot away. But I mean, even having seen that trailer myself, I very much enjoyed it. There were still things that, you know, I wasn't expecting. It still didn't quite play out how I was expecting it to. It's the sort of film you want to see with friends, so that when you leave you can just like all just go and talk about it. It's that kind of film. It was a lot of fun.
Cool. I'm seeing that next week. I can't wait. And then we can talk about it in detail. Don't give me any spoilers. Shall we crack on then? It's time to talk to the creators of this.
They'll have something they really want. What's your gut? It's going to be my funeral you're going to next.
You want to make an omelet? You got to kill some people.
You must be Lloyd. What gave it away? The trash stash. It leans Lloyd.
So that is The Grey Man, directed by the Russo brothers. And Matt, you had a little sit down with them yesterday to talk about the film. Shall we have a little listen to what they had to say about Bond, Gosling, and the Marvel actor that they'll be working with next?
Let's talk about your new film, The Grey Man, an action-packed espionage thriller starring Ryan Gosling and Chris Evans. And it's something you first started working on a long time ago, wasn't it, when you were making Captain America the Winter Soldier? So what was it about it that's kind of kept your interest for so long?
It was a great novel. It was a great read. It was one of those books that I read in about 2 days. Couldn't put it down. And Anth and I like excess, and we like propulsive thrillers. And the action in it was excessive, and, you know, the read was propulsive. So it begged to be converted into a visual story. I worked on a draft of it during Winter Soldier as a potential next film for us, but then we ended up doing 3 more movies for Marvel, so we put it aside. Circled back to it years later when we started our company, Agbo. We bought the rights back from Sony, took it out to the market, and set it up at Netflix. They're a great partner.
Do you think it would have been a very different film had you have made it back then? Kind of, have you sort of learned a lot along the way that's kind of influenced how this ended up being made?
It's hard to answer that hypothetical question because the process of making a movie is so complex. You know, until you actually do it, you don't really know what it is. But I will say this, over the course of the Marvel movies, we have been able to find such an amazing collaborative team in terms of how we execute action specifically, that I think the fact that we've worked together now for so many years over so many films, we have developed a pretty sophisticated process with one another. And I think that, you know, that certainly speaks to our ability to pull off certain complicated ideas.
Key to The Gray Man is this sort of cat and mouse aspect between Ryan Gosling's character, Sierra Six, and Chris Evans, Lloyd Hansen. When you were thinking about casting these two roles, were you kind of thinking in pairs, or did one kind of come first?
We always try to think in pairs. You know, it gives you a feeling of what you're going for. It gives you a tone. But, you know, we're fortunate enough that somebody at Chris's level was interested in playing a villain. And that's obviously a tricky role to cast. It's why you rarely see these sorts of showdown movies. It's hard to find, you know, somebody who's at the peak of their career who's interested in playing a sociopath or a very unlikable character on screen. Chris obviously told us that he feels like he was at a comfortable place post-Marvel and was really interested in taking risks. And so we really wrote the role up for him. And Gosling is just a dream to work with. I mean, he's an actor's actor. It's, you know, we've been obsessed with him for the last two decades, just like everyone else. So it was a great complimentary casting situation where, you know, we were just fortunate enough to get two guys really at the top of their game.
I mean, and on one level, you know, the movie is designed as a mano a mano, and for us between the hero and the villain. So to have two actors of equal sort of consequence, you know, especially at the level of Chris and the level of Ryan, it was an incredible privilege and for us to be able to play with that.
And so Chris, in a sense, he played the ultimate good guy in your Marvel movies. Yeah. So were you talking then about kind of doing something very different with him? Had you kind of thrown any ideas around during those movies?
We definitely did. Look, we had an amazing experience working with Chris on the Captain America character. I mean, it's just like, you know, to be able to explore that character for so many years over four films, that was a very unique creative experience for all of us. So yeah, we got to know Chris very well through that period, creatively and personally. And we started to understand, you know, things he was capable of, started to thinking about things, you know, very different from Captain America. I mean, certainly on one level, it tickled all of us to sort of go to work again on a character that is so, you know, couldn't get further from Captain America. And it's fun. And I think it was very liberating for Chris, too. You know, it's fun to play, to not have to carry the weight of the movie on your shoulders as the lead character. You know, you can sort of be a little more whimsical and indulgent in your performances. You know, you don't always have to make sure the audience is constantly tethered to you on an emotional level. So it was really fun to see Chris work that way.
There's kind of a reference to 007 at one point in the film, and then there's kind of a moment in Henry Jackman's score where I felt like he was almost invoking the James Bond movies. So were those films a big influence on you?
Absolutely. Yeah.
For sure. And we're being self-referential. I mean, we're certainly swimming in a pool that's been swam in many times before. So we're very aware of, you know, the legacy of films that have preceded this. You know, Anth and I have a hard time taking anything seriously. So there's always a level of biting humor. You know, self-awareness. So I think, you know, there's no universe where we're going to make a movie like this and not have a 007 joke in there somewhere.
And talking of 007, obviously you have Ana de Armas in the film as well. She's just come from, you know, has that amazing scene in the No Time to Die.
Yeah.
So was she kind of very action ready when she turned up for The Gray Man?
She was, but yeah.
I think she was even more sort of interested in, like, learning and growing, which is amazing. You know, there were many members of the cast where this movie represented an opportunity to engage in a type of performance that even they may have done some of before, but never to this level. And Anna was certainly approached the action challenge in this film that way. She trained extremely hard. She studied very, very hard. Just, you know, we have amazing advisors, former CIA agents, former special forces agents that worked very closely with the cast in terms of understanding behavior, psychology, etc., technique. And Anna really really hit it hard.
Is it hard to know when you're at that casting stage who's actually going to be able to handle the sort of demands that a sort of an action film on this scale?
It is a little bit of guesswork, but you're right. Like it you know, the physicality required is unique, and it's a different kind of skill set. It's interesting, having made superhero films, for those actors to maintain that physique for that period of time is very difficult. It's hard on them. It's hard on their bodies. It's mentally exhausting, especially when Anthony and I are sitting at the monitor eating pizza. When you do an action film, you're asking quite a bit of an actor. They're making quite a number of sacrifices, and they're engaging in a lot of really intense training. I think it was an interesting experience for Ryan because he'd never done anything of this scale before. He was an absolute trooper. You know, he would do 2 months of training, and then Anthony and I would come up with a different idea and throw out those 2 months of training. Never complained once, and always exerted all effort and energy to try and make it the best story that we could.
And The Grey Man obviously features many huge set pieces. How much of that is sort of in the script when it sort of goes to the actors? How much is sort of developed as you're going along, you know, and then how much, if at all, does it change on the day when you're actually sort of filming it?
There's definitely an evolution to it, right? We were very fortunate in the sense that we got to start with a great novel that had a number of these set pieces in it. Certainly at the script stage, there's a whole new layer added to that process. But we work with an incredible team of collaborators who... it's very hard to come up with that level of action. So we go through an involved process that involves conceptual artists sort of working with us to come up with certain concepts and ideas about the various sequences. We will actually animate certain sequences as a way to test drive them and explore them. We will work with our stunt team and actually shoot sections of the action, sections of the fights, in a stunt gym, and we'll edit it and to feel it out. We will start to collaborate with the actors as they get involved and feel out what their point of view is on the action. So it's a really elaborate layering process and a long sort of process of evolution to get to the point where you're ready to shoot something that is this complex. And again, we're trying to make the most exciting movie we possibly can. And there's definitely a bit of experimentation and trial and error in terms of finding that movie.
And you made Cherry, which had a very different role for Tom Holland in it, and you've just made The Grey Man, which has this very different role for Chris Evans in. In your next movie, The Electric State, are you going to be subverting Chris Pratt's image in that?
Maybe.
Chris Pratt is the president of the United States. I don't know. We'll keep under wraps Mr. Pratt's character for now, but yeah, we're very excited to be going to work with him.
Nice little chat, Matt. Were they nice chaps? And you, I think you also had a little star spot whilst you were doing that, didn't you?
Yes. I walked past Chris Evans himself in the corridor as I was going to my interview, which was obviously exciting.
I hope you saluted Cap.
I did, yes. Very nice to chat to the brothers again. I've interviewed them about 6 times over the years across all the Marvel movies and Cherry and things like that. So always good to catch up with them. And they, you know, they had some very interesting choices for their last picture show interview, which we did as well. So if you want to listen to that, check out our sister podcast, Total Film's Last Picture Show, when that drops tomorrow.
Indeed. Okay. So if you want to see The Grey Man and you haven't seen that yet, and that little chat has whetted your appetite, it hits Netflix tomorrow, which is exciting. I mean, it's good on the big screen, but I think I might actually watch it again on a small screen because it was a good time, a good Friday night for me. Okay, shall we move on? It's time to travel to the marshes with this.
Sometimes I feel so invisible. I wonder if I'm here at all.
You are.
I think you're gorgeous. I want to get to know you better.
There's no fingerprints on the railing, the grates, nothing.
No fingerprints?
Being isolated was one thing. Being hunted, quite another.
So this is where the crawdads sing. What are crawdads? Where are they singing, Matt?
There's very limited screen time, if any, for crawdads in this film. You know, it's just where the Crawdad Sea is just mentioned as a bit of a sort of sentimental location in the film. But this is based on the absolutely mega selling novel by Delia Owens from a few years ago. I haven't read the book. I know you have, Jane. I haven't read it myself. But we begin basically with a murder, like the aftermath of a murder, and a young woman whose name is Catherine Clark, but she's nicknamed Kaya by her family for reasons, again, which I don't think were ever really explained in the film. I never really known Kaya to be a shortening of Catherine, but there you go. Kaya, as she's known, played by Daisy Edgar Jones of Normal People fame. She's basically sort of on trial for the murder of a young man who sort of was a bit of a sort of star quarterback of the town, this sort of North Carolina town near where she grew up. She's very much a sort of social outcast. She's grown up entirely alone in this sort of marsh, living in a shack in the marsh, as we see in flashback from her childhood, where she was kind of completely abandoned by all members of her family there, and she lived there alone, grew up there alone. So she's sort of known to the locals as the marsh girl, and she's this outsider. So the odds are sort of stacked against her in this case, really, because of, you know, just her social standing. But a kindly lawyer played by David Strathairn sort of shows up, and he sort of agrees to sort of come out of retirement and help her out and sort of defend her in this case. From then on, the film's a kind of a blend of sort of a little bit of murder mystery, a little bit of courtroom drama, and a little bit of sort of Nicholas Sparks type sort of period flashback romance. And so, yeah, so it's sort of a blend of all that, really.
Does it work? I mean, this is a Reese Witherspoon production with, you know, she obviously has her book club and she snapped up the rights to this to create this film. Is it something that people are going to want to see? I mean, well, I really enjoyed the book. The book was a real page turner. Mm. And I'm sort of interested to see how they'll make the thriller element of that with this film.
As a non-book reader, I had extremely mixed feelings about it. And like, I was very, very pleased to see, because this is already out in the US, I was very pleased to see that it did a very solid opening weekend numbers, which is reassuring for this type of film, you know, kind of broadly aimed at adults, the sort of thing that has got more TV time in recent years. And so it's nice to know that something like this can play at cinemas and attract an audience. But I didn't really like it, to be honest. It just didn't really work for me. I really, really like Daisy Edgar Jones, and I absolutely loved Normal People. I really liked her in Fresh as well earlier this year. There's something sort of very engaging about her, and you can kind of easily understand why everyone who kind of comes into her orbit sort of falls in love with her. But it was one of those films that it just didn't quite add up for me. And if you didn't know, you can sort of totally tell that it's adapted from a book, with its sort of the nature of the narration and the sort of this flashback structure it has. I don't know how this compares to the book, but to me, it felt so sanitized, really. It was so glossy. Daisy Edgar Jones, obviously, she's this woman who's lived in the marsh alone since childhood. And she's, you know, this outcast, but she just looks sort of immaculately beautiful all the way through. Her hair always looks sort of incredibly glossy. She's always in nice clothes and dresses. So it's kind of hard to really sort of see her as this recluse figure who's just been completely shunned by society. It just didn't really work for me. It was watchable enough. It wasn't one of those that I, you know, that you would want to switch off. It was easy to watch, but it wasn't what I would classify as good.
But perfect plane movie. Ashanti, is it a perfect plane movie for you, or did it move you a little bit more?
I really enjoyed it. I think I was looking for something on the big screen that wasn't CGI'd. So we've had an onslaught of that in the last God knows how long. And it was nice to see this kind of real life whodunit type story. Daisy Edgar Jones, I thought, was absolutely, you know, fabulous. I agree with Matt totally that she was immaculate. Too immaculate to play a marsh girl. But at the same time, I thought, you know, why not? She had this black couple in their town that she would kind of take this boat and go to. And they kind of helped her kind of groom herself. They helped her with schooling. And I really liked that aspect where they showed that somebody who was an outcast could also bring something of themselves to the world. She became a kind of famous, you know, artist and somebody who tracked wildlife and drew wildlife. You know, she dated, she managed to find love. All of these things you wouldn't expect of her. And I love a good underdog story. And this is what this felt like to me. And the female gaze that Olivia Newman brings to this, I thought was quite spot on. I really enjoyed watching it. Every scene was beautiful. Polly Morgan, again, a woman bringing the scenes to life, gave it that romance, I felt, as a cinematographer. And my music by Michael Dana, I've always liked his work. He's done films like Life of Pi, and he does very beautiful scores. So this, in many ways, worked for me in a huge way. Daisy Edgar Jones, I felt, just carried it. I could see why her face was so hugely put on all the marketing materials and the poster, because she owned the role like it was her own. And yes, it was a little sanitized. It felt like, how did she have all these cozy cushions and
I mean, maybe Home Depot, you know, delivers by barge. I don't know. But
You know, I mean, so there were some incredulous bits in it, you know, but hey, I just felt that they gave us something very solid. And the amount of people who watch this in the US just shows to me that people have a bit of superhero fatigue at the moment, as much as I like all of that. And it felt good to just watch a real looking film in many ways without the CGI.
I mean, it's not filmed in North Carolina. It's actually filmed in Louisiana and around the Poncharon Lake, and so it's that Spanish moss and oak trees, and it is very picturesque. I mean, it's like a postcard sort of film for the New Orleans area, isn't it? You know, I think it's just really encouraging that people are going to see all sorts of different movies. They're seeing a Top Gun, they're seeing an Elvis, they're seeing a Thor, and they're seeing this. That just means to me that, not that necessarily that people are fatigued with the other stuff, but just that they're like ready to go back in the cinema and be sitting in the darkness with other people and allowing a story to be told to them uninterrupted, like the wonderfulness of the cinema that you get. Well, unless you're in there with people on their phones, which does happen. But generally people go in there to be uninterrupted by, you know, the washing machine finishing or whatever else it is that interrupts your viewing when you're watching something at home. So yeah, I think it's very encouraging. Let's talk about the ending without any spoilers, obviously. In the book, it's quite the sort of surprising ending. They have kept to the ending of the book. What did you think about that? Did you think that was a bold choice?
From my perspective, I had never read the book, so I walked in totally cold, and I loved the ending. I just felt that they nailed it with the ending, the way they wove it in, the way they built up to it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It actually felt perfect to me.
Yeah, again, it was just another element of the film that there were aspects of the, you know, of the broader ending of the film that, despite everything, I still found myself a little bit moved by it. It's one of those films that, you know, it's impossible not to be just a little bit touched by some of the things that happen in the way that you're sort of, you know, powerless against certain Nicholas Sparks films. Didn't entirely work for me. It almost clanged a little bit at the end for me. Again, I wondered, having not read it, if certain things played out differently in the book when you've got that more time to sort of luxuriate it in the book and, you know, just the more detail you can go into. But that didn't really work. And it's sort of, I've just also reminded myself that, I don't know if this plays differently in the book, but I just didn't buy it when she's grown up not knowing how to sort of read and write. So her first love, this nice boy who she meets, kind of teaches her how to read and write. And then before long, she's kind of suddenly she's illustrating and writing encyclopedias about marsh life. It just felt like, just, it was like, whoa, where did that come from? It added to that over glossy, over sanitized kind of feel. Like there's no feel of sort of, you know, grubbiness to this marsh at all. So, you know,
but sometimes that's what you want. I have to say, well, I have a, you know, soft spot in my heart for Nicholas Sparks, you know. I don't mind that. You know what you're getting.
I just made it sound like the perfect sort of Friday night watch.
Yeah, indeed.
There's certain people I would actually recommend it to, even though I didn't really like it that much myself.
I mean, I've been watching The Summer I Turned Pretty on Prime Video. And again, I like that kind of thing. I like to escape into certain worlds like that. Equally, I like to watch, you know, a Miss Marvel type thing. So this certainly felt like something that was nice to watch, a nice little break from what I usually watch. And yeah, totally, I would recommend it to everyone.
Okay, so if you fancy Where the Crawdads Sing, it is out in cinemas this Friday. Okay, it's time for alternative line reading, and I'm going to look ahead to my answer to the reader's question this week and do this in the style of Mrs. Doubtfire. This is a line from a film of somebody who's in a film we've already talked about. So, are you ready? I don't reckon I've got no reason to kill nobody.
I'm afraid. I don't know if it's just the Mrs. Doubtfire accent, but I've got no idea what this one is.
Might that be a film that Billy Bob Thornton
is? Yes. Yes, Getting Warmer, Ashanti.
Sling Blade.
Sling Blade, yes. And obviously he says it in his very distinctive way, and it sounds something like this.
Will you ever kill anybody again, Carl?
I don't reckon I got no reason to kill nobody.
Okay, should we move on? It's time to pause for pause, which was paused for some years. It's this.
We need a new samurai.
Not it.
Okay, here goes nothing.
What the mother father cocker spaniel's going on here?
Sometimes you need a friend.
Sounds like you need help.
Fun to see you win.
Hey, this is the training montage, isn't it?
Don't forget to land on your feet.
So this is Pause of Fury. Ashanti, tell us what this is about. What? Whose paws and why are they furious?
Well, this is Paws of Fury, The Legend of Hank. It's an animated martial arts comedy. It's set in feudal Japan in a land inhabited by cats. Here we have Hank, who is a bumbling beagle, as he's called, who wants to become a samurai. So here's a dog who wants to be in a cat's world. And he kind of gets pulled in by this character called Ikachu. He is played by Ricky Gervais, who I absolutely adore this man. Don't ask me why. I just think he's fabulous. And he plays this, just like Matt just laughed there. He is very, very funny as this kind of warmongering Somali cat. It basically, he just kind of wants to take over the world. And he has created things like this giant toilet and all kinds of weird things are going on. They kind of allow you to see literally what a Chinese whisper looks like. So that's one part to watch out for in this. And for me, the best thing about this was Samuel L. Jackson as Jimbo. He's a sensei. He's, you know, a cat who helps Michael Cera as Hank, who's the beagle, to kind of become this cool samurai that he wants to become. And in this film, you've got other voices, George Takei, you've got Jimon Hounsou, you've got Michelle Yeoh, you've got Asif Mandvi, and you've also got this very interesting Persian cat called Emiko, who do look out for her, because not only is she super cute, and I am a total sucker for cute looking animals. So I'm allergic to both cats and dogs. So in real life, I can't even go near them. Quite scared of dogs, you know, I wouldn't even go near them. But when they're on screen, I think when they look at you with those big, big, big googly eyes, I have a total love for them. And in this one, incredibly cute Emiko, she's played by Kyle Kuyoka. She is absolutely adorable. She's this tiny little cat who wants to also become a samurai. This is all about protecting this one town that the evil Ricky Gervais character of Ikachu wants to kind of destroy, because it's in his eyeline. He doesn't like it because he thinks it doesn't look good, which, you know, is a lot of frivolous fun. I laughed a lot watching this. It's available on Sky Cinema. And what can I say? It's one of those where you kind of wonder, this guy, Rob Ralph Minkoff, you know, he's directed films like The Lion King. So he comes, and Stuart Little, which I absolutely loved. You kind of wonder why they keep going to Japan saying, oh, let's just turn all these American characters into Japanese characters, but they all speak with American English. So it's kind of one of those weird decisions. Why have they chosen to make it? At the same time, there's not a lot of movies out there for kids at the moment, and it is summertime and holidays are coming up.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, you're going to want to pack your kids in front of something, aren't you, this summer?
Yeah.
This will probably do the trick. I mean, it has been long delayed. It was supposed to come out how many years ago? Years and years ago. Been delayed, been shopped around, ended up on Sky. Is that where it should be, on a small screen?
I think this should be watched on the big screen. I think the animation in this was very impressive. And it's a loose adaptation of a Mel Brooks film, actually, Blazing Saddles. Just kind of learn
Blazing Saddles. You've never seen Blazing Saddles?
I've not seen it, no. So I'm like,
right, Ashanti, that is your homework as soon as you have finished talking here. Go and see Blazing Saddles. It's amazing.
and so this, I think kids will really like it. I'm a big kid at heart. And Mel Brooks himself actually plays Toshi in this as well. So it's got quite a lot going for it. I feel like it's one of those films that, you know, it's like Paw Patrol, these sorts of films where they are made for children. They have very much a demographic in mind when they make this film. And for me, you know, I have no problems watching it. If I had to take my niece and nephew to see it during the holidays, I will gladly do it.
Going to go and see it, Matt? I mean, obviously,
maybe, yeah.
You can see it on Now TV as well as Sky. So I think, yeah, it's an easy thing to pop on.
I'll be giving it a whirl on Sky, I think. I don't think I'll be going out to the cinema to it. I mean, if it was live action with that cast, for sure. I'd love to see Samuel L. Jackson mentoring Michael Cera in live action, but just the subtitle of The Legend of Hank just doesn't really sort of inspire me that much.
Yeah.
Could have given him like a funnier name or something.
Hank is quite funny in itself though, isn't it? Cats with a person's name. I always enjoy animals that have like a dog called Brian or something. That always tickles me immensely.
One more thing to say is that Rob Minkoff, his wife is Crystal Kong Minkoff. And I have a feeling this is an ode to give to his wife who has roots in that part of the world.
Okay, well, there we go. If you fancy Paws of Fury, it is on Sky and Now TV and in cinemas this Friday. Right, shall we move on then to a show that has finally sort of come to an end with a bang, with a great reveal, with a what? It's this.
I always thought I wanted this kind of life, but I never imagined any of this.
Do you even know what you are?
I'm a superhero.
Okay, so this is Ms. Marvel, and Ashanti, you're in the current issue talking about how much this show means to you in terms of representation, but also just in terms of this being something that people are enjoying as much as they, you know, enjoyed WandaVision when it came out. This has been a really fun Marvel show and a big revelation at the end, which was...
We find out that, you know, during the show, so let's just say that during this show, six episodes, initially you think, is it the bangle that's giving her power? Then you wonder, is she a djinn? Is she, you know, an inhuman? In the comics, she was an inhuman. The Terrigen Mist kind of falls on her and that's how she gets the powers to embiggen, etc. But in the show, they've been very evasive and elusive about this because you kind of have to wonder all the way through. And right at the end, just right at the end, she gets told that there is a mutant gene in her. So you kind of wonder, ooh, we've already had a glimpse of some of the X-Men from a different dimension, of course. They're not quite in the 616 universe, but you know, you kind of wonder, is this kind of a lead up to that? You also know that she's going to be in the Marvels and, you know, she's going to be joining, you know, Monica Rambeau, and she's going to be joining Carol Danvers. So there's a lot to kind of unpick and think about with this. In some ways, is she the first mutant in the MCU? That's, I guess, the big question.
Yes, that is the big question. I mean, we got the 90s X-Men theme playing, didn't we?
Yes.
So what does that mean with the various iterations of X-Men? What do you think, Matt?
Well, it really does feel like they're gearing up to introduce the X-Men in a big way, because obviously it was announced quite a while ago that the X-Men would be coming into the MCU. But this was sort of one of the biggest sort of glimpses yet we've had of how that could look moving forward. And obviously very much suggesting that Kamala's going to be at the forefront of that. We get a little bit of the X-Men animated theme, similar to what we had in Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, when Patrick Stewart turns up as Professor X in one of these sort of alternate timelines. They keep referencing the cartoon, and obviously Marvel are working on a new kind of animated sequel to that
series, that beloved animated series from the 90s that's going to be called X-Men 97, that's going to be picking up where that left off. So, I mean, are we to expect sort of the aesthetics of that show for mutants in the MCU? Maybe it'll all tie with that. But, I mean, it certainly feels like a big deal. And feels like it's going to have a sort of a huge influence on the MCU going forward.
Do you think it's like one of the big sort of mic drops of the Marvel shows we've seen so far?
Yes, I would say so. Yeah, it's, in terms of what it means for the future, it felt like in terms of the shows and the recent movies, I'd say, in terms of a big idea of where this could all be going next. So it will be very, very intriguing to see what happens. We've obviously got Comic-Con happening this weekend where there's going to be a Marvel panel. So it will be interesting to see if they what they announce there, if they announce like loads of stuff coming up, or if they are a bit more sort of tight-lipped. But I mean, it's the first time they've done a big Comic-Con panel in a while, I think. So we live in hope of huge announcements, obviously.
Yeah. But I mean, it's safe to say that Ms. Marvel is going to be a huge part of any plans for Marvel going forward. She just opened a new ride at Disneyland in Europe with Brie Larson. She's very much part of their forward going plans, which is amazing to see, isn't it, Shanti?
Absolutely, because not only is there a lot of representation that she has brought to the Marvel Universe, being the first female South Asian superhero, being the first Muslim superhero who has been designated as a Muslim, because with Kingo in Eternals, he is played by a Muslim person in Kumail Nanjiani, but actually he's not, you know, described as a Muslim. You're not seeing him practicing his faith in any way. But in this, you kind of get a glimpse into a real Pakistani life, which I thought was brilliant. They took her to Karachi, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. And, you know, this is the diaspora experience that many of us have felt. She is certainly a big player in the Marvel Universe. And, you know, there's all this stuff that we saw at the end of Doctor Strange as well, the kind of incursions that are happening. And we know that there's something big that's building up in the Marvel.
Something's brewing
in a very big way. And also what's interesting in this is that, you know, we've watched Loki and all that stuff about the TVA and about time travel, and they bring time travel into Ms. Marvel as well. And this is another interesting thing, because is it like a predestined paradox for Ms. Marvel? Because her great-grandmother has summoned her from the future to actually save herself in so many ways. And that was interesting, because they didn't add this kind of branch to the timeline that they could have added and then violated the kind of TVA time travel rule. So there are so many things for us to think about with Ms. Marvel, especially with the bangle and the Legend of the Ten Rings and the end of Shang-Chi as well, that you saw that this potentially could have come from that same kind of alternate dimension, and all those people who were there as protectors, et cetera, from Shang-Chi. So all those little end stingers that Marvel have been giving us in movies like Shang-Chi and Doctor Strange, and, you know, even with Thor, these are all going to connect up, and there are dots to join up. And Kamala Khan's storyline is pivotal to all of this. So
it's exciting, isn't it? What's ahead? What's coming down the line?
And of course, we must mention as well, there was also a post-credit scene at the end of the last episode as well, where, sort of not completely surprisingly, we saw Brie Larson's Carol Danvers, who obviously Kamala's a massive fan of. She appeared when Kamala just kind of disappears in like a sort of flash of energy, and she's sort of replaced by Carol Danvers, aka Captain Marvel, who's, you know, in a new suit, slightly new look for her. And obviously you've got no idea what's actually going on there, but it will no doubt tie into the Captain Marvel sequel, The Marvels, which obviously features Iman Vellani as well. So again, that's really sort of teasing up another sort of big film coming up in the MCU as well. So that was a sort of fun, if confusing, note to end on.
Yes, I mean, they always give you answers, but then also give you a load more questions, don't they? That's the Marvel way. Give you a something delightful, and then also where you're like, what does it mean? The Marvels is coming out next year, so we've got quite a wait for that. It feels like it's going to be exciting, and it feels like there's going to be a lot of female stories in where we're going with the Marvel Universe, which is great to see.
They're introducing to us the whole young batch. And I feel like they might at least make us an animated series on that, because we've seen America Chavez now. We've seen kind of Miles Morales from the other realm, almost from the Sony Marvel universe. And then the Disney Marvel universe is giving us all of these young teenagers. So it'll be interesting also to see what they do with that, because I feel like since they've already given us What If, I feel like there are lots of things they can play with that they can make in an easier way. They've got all the facilities to make us more animated series as well. So they can definitely do that. Even the kind of the new Groot spin-off that's coming up. It's interesting because he also probably will be a teenager.
Like, yeah.
Hey, Teenage Avengers. Maybe that's coming up as well. So let's see.
Well, we'll be here for that, won't we? So that is all we have time for this week. Thanks so much for all your nerding out, Ashanti. We'll be back next week. But before we go, there is time for a listener question. And I love this because it's completely random. What's the best use of fruit in a movie, Matt?
The sort of second thing that came to mind when you asked this just now was, the first thing was one that I think you'll go for, so I won't mention it, which is a certain piece of fruit in Call Me By Your Name.
But, I wasn't. Oh, you can go for that, though.
But no, but I'll avoid that. The thing that pops in my head was the orange that's peeled by the young leader played by Jesse Buckley in Maggie Gyllenhaal's film The Lost Daughter, which came out last year. And it's just this sort of special way she has of peeling it, where it kind of gets the whole peel off in one sort of unbroken piece. I just like the way it just felt really sort of believable that the kids would be obsessed with that, and it would be a little kind of, you know, family connection and something that, you know, something so trivial that meant a lot to them and sort of represented something significant. So that's one that really stuck in my mind.
I know Jane's probably expecting me to say Minions and Banana, but I actually had a really amazing experience, immersive experience, going to Dirty Dancing Secret Cinema, and I remembered the significance of watermelons.
The watermelon, yeah. Did you carry a watermelon?
I actually, weirdly enough, my mom gave me a watermelon the weekend before. And then I went to this Dirty Dancing thing and I saw all the watermelons. They had watermelons peppered around the place. And I just thought, this question couldn't have come at a more fortuitous moment, because there I was immersing myself into Dirty Dancing, where the film was screened in open air in Acton Town, of all places. And many people had kind of brought their own watermelons as well. People were all dressed up. Secret Cinema.
Those are heavy things. You're going to regret that at the end of the evening.
Well, they brought knives. They cut it. They were eating it.
Okay.
It was all like really.
But that's amazing. The thing with a watermelon, don't you find? Like, you buy one and then you eat it for like two or three meals, and then you're like, oh my god, how many more meals?
I've got to go and force down some watermelon after we finish this.
You're just chowing through that thing.
I mean, what else can you get in this kind of weather? But
you've got to sprinkle a bit of salt on it as well, just to bring out the taste.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm. Oh, what I was going to say is always keep it in the fridge. It's essential because the watermelon just doesn't taste so good when it's kept outside.
No, it has to be cold with a bit of salt. So my fruit is, obviously, now that you've mentioned it, we do have to mention that defiled peach in Call Me By Your Name. That, I mean, when you read that in the book, you're like, I can't imagine that being on a film. And then you see the film and you're like, I can't even believe that they managed to make that so sensual, a boy pleasuring himself with a peach. So yes, that is an amazing use of a fruit. And I wonder how many people who watched it went and tried that. But my piece of fruit, which I always enjoy, is Mrs. Doubtfire, when Daniel, as Mrs. Doubtfire, is forced to go for lunch with the man who is now seeing his ex-wife, who's Pierce Brosnan, and he's so frustrated by him that he picks up a passing lemon and wangs at his head and then says, "Oh, I don't know how that happened. It was a drive-by fruiting." And a drive-by fruiting is now something that is said regularly in my house. If any kind of fruit falls off a fruit bowl or is rolling across the floor, it's a drive-by fruiting. So that's mine. But also, I mean, we can't not mention the oranges in The Godfather, the significance of death with an orange.
You can't not do an impression of Don Corleone whenever you're having an orange after you've seen The Godfather, can you?
No, absolutely not. Okay, on that note, we will say a fruity farewell. Say goodbye, Matt.
Goodbye.
Say goodbye, Ashanti.
Farewell.
And it's goodbye from me.
Moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat me a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. Peaches come from a can.